We have chairs here. Thank good. I'm glad people have to sit on the side. Okay. What we entitled our five week mini series is Jewish Law Confronts the 21st Century. I just want to give a 1 minute introduction to the whole topic. Why? Who cares that Jewish law in the 21st century, the 18th century, Jewish thought that we just had a couple classes on. So that I understand that may change. There are new ideas in the world, but Jewish law is a divine system. So the notion that there's a difference in the 20th century and 21st century, and I'm not just talking on technology. Obviously, the technology changes, but those are not changes in Jewish law. Basically, some of the issues revolve around on social issues, and the change. That's too bad. Okay. Then the change in social issues, how it impacts on Jewish law. So I want to start with a quote in Vayigash, when the 70 people go down, when Yaakov Avinu and his children and the grandchildren go to Egypt. So it says in the Chumash that Yehuda shalach lefanav et Yosef, and Yehuda was sent ahead. Judas, the fourth brother, was sent ahead. Lehorot lefanav Goshna, to teach in Goshen. We know how the Jewish people lived in Goshen. And our rabbis say he was sent ahead to establish a Beit Midrash. He was to establish a place of learning. So really what I believe our rabbis are driving at is that when we're going to enter a new land, a new social conditions, and a whole new environment, you have to reapply Jewish law. The law that was in Eastern Europe doesn't going to apply in America. The same principles will apply. But you have to set up, you have to understand how Egypt works. Egypt is not Israel. And Lithuania is not America, and America is not Israel. So you have to set up a system where law can make sense within that system. So it's always very important, probably the more difficult aspect of Jewish law is to understand the social reality in which you live. To know Jewish law isn't necessarily so hard, but it's to figure out how to apply what aspect to what law, that's really our challenge. So that's just by way of introduction. Now, our first topic is going to be on charity and problems in charity. And I want to start, which I think is the fundamental problem, that charity is no longer an enjoyable mitzvah. I don't know if you agree or disagree with me, but can feel free to comment that. I think, unfortunately, what's happened is many of us are so bombarded, and every turn we go, by so many causes, many of which are very worthy. I'm not even talking about the unworthy ones. It's also an issue. And we're at a loss, and people who have kids in the day school system are being strangled by our tuition, and then they're being asked by their shul and by where they graduated and this one and that one, and they're being asked all over. And people feel a burden in the mitzvah of tzedakah, and that's a real tragedy. And so I want to discuss really what I want to get at. How can we turn the mitzvah into something which is no longer a burden on us? And with that, I want to begin with a beautiful comment of the Maharal of Prague, living in the 16th century in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, as the chief rabbi. It says in Mishpatim, Im kesef talve et ami. If you lend the people in our nation money, if you lend them money, you can't charge them interest. That's the context of the verse. And our sages comment that this is one of three times in the Torah where the word im, if you lend somebody money, don't charge them interest. This is one of the three ifs in the Torah that doesn't mean if, it means when. Because it's not an option to give somebody a loan. We know, according to Maimonides, the highest form of charity is a loan. It's not a gift. You give somebody a loan so they can go into business and repay you and get on their own 2 feet. That's much higher than a handout. That's, if you want to put it in contemporary terms. So Israel bonds would be a greater mitzvah than in the UGA. Without getting into details, but on a conceptual level, Israel bonds would be a greater mitzvah because it's being invested. So it's not an option. If you have the money, you have an obligation to lend the money. So the Maharal asks, if that's the case, why doesn't it say so in the Torah? Why doesn't the Torah say, when you lend money, don't charge interest? Why does the Torah have to say, if you lend money, if it really means when? Why doesn't the Torah say what it means? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Okay, so I will. So the Maharal answers a beautiful answer, that it's true that there's an obligation to give charity and to lend money. But the obligation should be done not out of a sense of obligation, but a sense I want to do it. When we do something because we have to do it, we don't have the same feeling when we do something because we want to do it. And the Torah is telling us, im kesef. A person should feel, when they're doing the mitzvah of tzedakah, they're doing because they want to do it, not because they have to do it. In reality, you have to do it. Whether you want to or you don't, you have to do it. But it shouldn't be done out of a feeling that, they're twisting my arm. It should be done out of a feeling of joy. And that's the problem I feel, and I think a lot of people feel, that we have today. That there, so it's very difficult how to choose what to give, what to do. So that's what I want to do, is try to address just some of these issues. Have here a little bit of a handout. We'll pass it along. Don't get scared by all the Hebrew stuff, because the last couple pages are all in English. One more here, okay. Okay. So I guess the first question I want to discuss is, when is it appropriate to say no? When is it appropriate not to give charity? And one should know that often it's appropriate not to, and perhaps it's even obligatory not to give charity. So if we take a look at the first source I have on the page, where I wrote, "Who can we trust? The management of funds." So this is a Talmudic passage in Bava Batra. It's interesting. Bava Batra basically talks on the laws of neighbors. If there are two neighbors, we have to build a fence so I can't see into your property. And in the first chapter of the tractate, the Talmud has a whole discussion on many of the laws of charity. And the Talmud says as follows. Tana Rabbanan, our rabbis learned, Gaba'et staka einam reshem lifrosh zemizeh, that when people collect charity, they're not allowed to separate from one another. Now it's interesting. The Talmud has already said that it is prohibited to have a lone charity collector. You're not allowed to collect charity if you're alone. How come? I can't trust the person. When it comes to money, we don't trust anybody. As a matter of fact, the Talmud tells us that the high priest is supposedly the symbol of spirituality, of religious ethic of our people. The high priest was not allowed to have any pockets in his clothing, because the Talmud would say, lest the people say he's pocketing all the money. There was a lot of money in the temple. All the sacrifices, everybody had to donate a half a shekel. There's a lot of commercial transaction going on in the temple. And the high priest would be accused of taking money, so he wasn't allowed to have any pockets. And Talmud said they actually had seven keys. In order to get to the treasury, you know, you have to have checks and balances in our modern day economy. So already in the Talmud, they were well aware of that. And there were seven different people who had to come to open up the room. You were never allowed to collect charity alone, which I believe means in our society you should never give cash as charity. You should always pay by check. That's how I understand the practical application of that. Unless if you're giving it to five people and they see, that's one thing. But it's much safer to pay by check, because there's a trace to it. That's what it means. We don't trust anybody. I don't care who it is and what the rabbi is. When it comes to money, we're always are suspicious. So we're going to come to there. So that's an excellent question, right? No, I'm talking the collectors now. I'm talking about the person who is soliciting. We don't trust the solicitor. Somebody asking for money is a slightly different situation. We'll come to that in a moment. We'll come to that hopefully, and if I don't, so ask it again, please. So the Gabai Tztaka, who were two people, were not allowed to separate one from another. And if you go down in the second paragraph, so Rashi, this is a comment of Rashi, Mifnei HaChashad, because we are suspicious. Shelo Yomru Zeh HaGove Yechidi Dato Lignov. We don't want to say the person who's collecting by himself, his intent is to steal. We don't want to say that. Now, who is appointed the charity warden? One says you can only appoint anyway a very reputable person. Very interesting. I don't want to go into here, but just to see to an extreme which this is taken, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great halachic authority of America in the 20th century, has a responsa where he is opposed to giving money to federations. And the reason he is opposed is because he felt that the people in charge of federation generally are not observant people, and their sense of how to allocate money may not be in keeping with the Jewish ethos that as he understood it. And therefore, he felt this was a violation. Not that he felt they are thieves, but he felt that you have to be very careful who you appoint. It has to be of integrity. Even people of great integrity cannot separate one from another. By the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein, just to be, I don't follow that opinion. I'll admit that. I do give money to Federation. I think it is important. Rav Moshe Feinstein will be the first to say, if you don't give money to Federation, you can't take money from Federation. You can't give the money. You can't say, I don't give to UJA because I don't like what they do. That's okay. No one is obligated to give to every charity. We're going to get to that. There is a limited amount of funds. I don't believe in what they do. I want to support this cause. Maybe that's okay. But then you can't turn around and say, I want you to support our schools, to support our way of life. So it's a two-way street. But in Rav Moshe's worldview, the wardens of the Federation, so to speak, were not in keeping with who it's supposed to be. But in the Talmud, you have two very, very observant people. And yet, mifnei ha-chashad, we are suspicious, shelo yimru zeh ha-goveh yechidi dato lignov. The person takes it by himself, he's going to pocket a few dollars, you can't trust him. And then it says in the Talmud, back on the first paragraph, matzama ot bashuk, the guy finds money in the street. No, their peers, he's collecting whatever in the pushka. Lo yitnam betoch kiso. He's not allowed to put the money into his own pocket. Whereas, often you walk over someone, you put the money in his pocket, and then he's going to give it to the charity. No, it shouldn't go through that middle person. He'll forget it in his pocket. He'll end up, he'll be at the pizza store. He forgot his wallet. So he's going to end up using the money you gave for charity. So it's very interesting. The Talmud right here sets up that the standards for honesty and integrity are very high. And we can't just appoint anybody. You have to know who the person is who you are giving to. And that is true to this day. What it means in practice is, unless you know for sure that the person collecting the charity is a man or woman of tremendous integrity, you personally know them, you should not give to an organization without audited financial statements. That's it says in the Shulchan Aruch that a Torah scholar, and a Torah scholar means, it's synonymous, it means an ethical person. A person who knows a lot of Torah but is not ethical is not a Torah scholar. He knows a lot of information, but a Torah scholar means an ethical person. So a Torah scholar is not obligated to give an accounting of the charity because we trust people. If you trust people, you trust them. However, the world in which we live in, and the Talmud says, if you don't know who the charity person is, they should give a accounting. And of course, in our society, with so many organizations and so much involvement, it would be, I believe, basically mandatory for every organization collecting money from the public to provide financial information, ideally an audited statement. It may not always be practical. It may be a very small charity. It may be too, cost ineffective. Whatever, you have to take on a case by case basis. But you should never give charity to an organization that is refusing to divulge its financial information. That's now, if you know the people and you trust them, whatever, he's a great rabbi, has started the yeshiva, and you know the person, you don't have to ask. I don't want everybody to think I'm never going to give any charity now until, I see the statements. UJA every year publishes in the paper how much money they collect, how much money they spend on administration, how much money goes to local education. That's the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to know. On that, it's understood that a charity has many expenses that are reasonable. But the first thing we have to know is the notion of openness and integrity that we expect from an organization. Now to get back to your question, so what do you do when a person on the street is asking for money? So there is a difference in Jewish law. There's a huge difference between an organization and a person. We have to divide the mitzvah of tzedakah into the personal component and the communal component. Today, most of us give money, I believe, in a communal way. We give either to UJA, to a yeshiva, to a school, to a hospital. Most of us do not come directly in contact with poor people. And even those organizations that are for the poor people, we're not giving to the poor person. From Cheshavis, whatever it is, we give to an organization that gives to the poor. So you give to an organization, that's where all these rules apply. The Talmud says when you give to an individual, a guy knocks on your door, says he doesn't have any food to eat. So you're going to check him out. Maybe he's lying. What car does he drive? This and that. So the Talmud says then you are supposed to give the person money. A person who comes for food, you give first and you ask questions later. A person who comes for clothing, you ask questions first and you give later. That's what it says. Now, probably in our society of today, it's also a little bit different. They didn't have a social welfare system in the time of the Talmud. People literally didn't know where their next meal is. It's very, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but if you remember about a year or so ago, the height of the Intifada, there was a report that a lot of Israeli children are below the poverty line and are going to bed hungry. And Sharon, I think, got very angry that how dare you say there are Jews in Israel who are hungry? We feed all our people. I don't know what is factually true. But we do live in a society where there is much more of a social welfare net, which means even with individuals, we have to be more careful. Because there are usually ways, if you give them a food stamp or they have in America, there are ways to provide things without just blanketly trusting people who come by. Where exactly you draw the line, I don't know exactly. It's very hard to know. But I would say like this, we today, you go, you spend a couple dollars every day on a coffee without thinking about it. The things we don't think about, so at least that much you can give to anybody who asks. You can do things like that. When you're talking already something you'd want to write a check for, now, is that already a couple dollars, who cares? So you can give it in cash. We're already talking $100, whatever it is, so even by an individual, I think we still do have an obligation to check somebody out. So that's a very important like notion that we don't believe in giving to everybody, except in the Shulchan Aruch it says on Purim. It says on Purim we're supposed to give. We're in such a good mood. We're drinking and spending. We don't know what's going on. But conceptually, we're as much, you know, we have to be very careful. And of course, we recognize because there's a limit. I don't care if you have $100 million. The needs are much greater than $100 million. Nobody has enough money to give to all the charity that is needed. So every single person has to pick and choose. And when you're giving to one charity, you're not always taking away. Sometimes you can give a little more. Sometimes you can stretch. But you have to allocate it very carefully. And to give to the wrong cause is something that is wrong. And so that's something we have to be very aware of, that the people of integrity are running our community organizations, and that they're running it in a degree of openness. So that's the first issue. Correct. Then you have to ask them. Then you don't have an obligation to give. I'll tell you an interesting story. A person I know made Aliyah. He worked for 5 or 6 years in America, and then it's in New York. And he made Aliyah, and he decided he lived in a small apartment when he was in America, and he saved up money so he could learn for 2-3 years in Kollel when he comes to Israel. And that's what he did. He went to Israel. He was learning for a couple of years on money he had saved. He wasn't asking anybody to pay for him. And one day he gets a knock on the door from somebody. He says, I need money to support my son who's learning in Kollel. And the guy said, I'm sorry. You want to support your son? Let him go work. I worked for a long time. I'm learning in Kollel because I saved the money. I don't have an obligation to support your son in Kollel. And he didn't give any money. After he closed the door on him, he felt very bad. Afterwards, he felt it's not really right. And he went to discuss it with Rav Aaron Lishishiv in Har Etzion where he was learning. I remember he told me the story. I may not be quoting it 100%. And he said that Rav Aaron really didn't have a clear answer. If you know Rav Aaron, he presents, you know, both sides of the issue. But it wasn't necessarily wrong what he did. It wasn't necessarily wrong. No, there's no obligation for everybody. You're not obligated to buy somebody an apartment in Jerusalem. I'll jump ahead a little bit. I strongly feel that we give way too much money to places outside of Toronto. And people in Cleveland give too much money outside in Cleveland and Boston. I don't want to use the word it's prohibited. That would be too strong a word. I'm not going to say that. But I think it's a misallocation of our resources for anybody to give money outside of our city unless it's in Israel. Israel's a different ballgame for a variety of reasons. But as long as there are needs in Toronto, first of all, it's a big waste of money. people from New York fly to Toronto, people from Toronto fly to New York. Like, to waste all the administrative costs, just let everybody in New York give in New York, and let everybody in Toronto give in Toronto. But it's cooler. Like people kind of like to give to things they don't. You know, they know the organization in Toronto. They know all the problems there. I don't want to support that one. That's our natural instinct, and that's an incorrect instinct. And it's very hard to know how to deal with it. But I don't think we should be giving very much money. You want to listen? I went to Yeshiva University, so I feel a personal obligation to give to Yeshiva University. That's something else. I personally benefited from them. There's maybe Yeshiva University is important because they provide rabbis for all of North America. Okay, maybe. Maybe yes, maybe not. The same thing with any organization. But to give to a yeshiva in Cleveland that you never learned there, why should you give? I'm not saying it's maybe wonderful work they do. It's great. If you had all the money in the world, you should give. But it's not your responsibility. And I think if all the money that went outside of Toronto stayed in Toronto, we could cut our day school tuition in half, I'm sure. So that is also another issue in Halacha. We know, the people in our city have to come first. So that's... Yes. Right. So I say like that, right.
I was taught, learned from my parents, my father, name it the bait, get the
right, money. Right. So I don't know Yiddish, but I probably agree with you. Somebody has to give, right? I understand. Yeah. Somebody has to give, right. Right. So I would. It says in the Torah, "Lo tikpos et yadcha." Don't close your heart. So some, your hand. Don't harden your heart, and don't close your hand. Both the heart and the hand. Kastaka is both an emotional thing, but it's also action oriented. So it turns out there is this notion that you should give to anybody who asks. There is in theory. So what I say in the supermarket, give him a dollar, or 25 cents, 50 cents, because you throw out a dollar 100 times a week without. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but people. In other words, if you can afford it, if you're the you buy an ice cream, right, exactly, because the obligation of tzedakah, interestingly enough, the minimum obligation is a pruta. Pruta is probably half a cent, maybe it's a nickel nowadays. I don't know. It's very little. It's very little. No, because a person who's very poor, a person who lives on welfare, a person who lives on charity, such a person is still obligated to give charity, but only this minimum. That person is not allowed to give 10 or 20% of their income. We know that the ideal, everybody knows, I'm not really talking about that. The ideal is to give really, really 20% is the ideal. 10% is sort of a decent. It's nice. It's very nice. But it's the ideal if you can afford it. Many, many people cannot afford 20%. They're not supposed to give. They're only supposed to give a very minimum after tax. After tax. If we have time, which may not, I'll come to that. So everybody has to give. So you're not allowed to give if you can't afford. By the way, that means that those people who get married and they're in medical school or in kollel or in law school and their parents are supporting them are not allowed to give large amounts of the tzedakah. It's not their money. Their parents are giving them money to support themselves. You're 23 years old. You're married. You're still in school. You don't have money. Your parents have agreed to support you. You can't turn around and give another $5,000 to my yeshiva, to this and that, and then ask your parents for money. That's not allowed. It's not your money. Okay. So I think we don't necessarily disagree. There is a law that if you inherit money, even though in Canada, there's no tax on inheritance. In Jewish law, there is a tzedakah tax on inheritance. When you get an inheritance or when you're given a large gift, you should give it. But what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, it depends what the gift is. If you're working and your father's a nice guy and he gives you $1 million house, you know, so then you do have to give to charity because you can go and support yourself. But if you don't have where to live and your father gives you a small 3-bedroom house so you can, while you're in law school and have 3 little kids, you can live, so then you can't give tzedakah. So I think it would depend on the situation. If they're giving it to you just as a living expense and you have no other means of support and they're only giving it to you till you can make your own money, you do not give any charity on it. But you're right. If your parents give you stocks and bonds and whatever in a house, you do have to give charity, which is why the most authorities, when you get married, the wedding gifts you have to give, also tzedakah. Because the wedding gifts are not given for you to support. They don't know. I don't think anybody gives a wedding gift dependent of the guys in law school or working. They give you the same amount of money, whatever they give when you go to a wedding. They're not giving it to you as living expenses. They're giving it to you as a gift. So on a gift, you do give charity. But if somebody is supporting you, you don't. So sometimes it's not always clear where the line is between gift giving and living expenses.
They should be giving.
Absolutely, they should be giving. A child at his bar mitzvah should be setting aside 10-20% for a charity. Absolutely. Right, he doesn't have that obligation. Okay, so my understanding, and I believe this is in the sources, I don't really have them here, but I prepared, is that living expenses do not count as a deduction from charity. Just like in Canadian tax law, you don't pay less tax depending on your living expenses. That's one of the issues I want to come to, RRSPs and all that kind of stuff. But living expenses do not count. You have to give stock. You earn $100,000 a year. Let's take, we already said taxes aren't included. You pay tax of $40,000 a year. You're left with $60,000. So let's say you're giving your 10%. You have an obligation of $6,000. The fact, what your living expenses are not relevant. However, if your living expenses, your basic living expenses are $58,000, and that's your basic normal living expenses, you don't live in extravagance, then you don't have to give $6,000. It's not that you're not obligated. There's an overriding obligation. Where does this, it comes up with so many hundreds of families in our city, is day school tuition. You're making $150,000 and have four kids in day school, you're not so wealthy. By the time you pay the $60,000 for four kids in day school, it's in high school, it's already, it's $15,000, $16,000. So you have a kid in Israel at $22,000, one in high school at $15,000, two in element, whatever. You're paying like $50,000 more or less after tax money. So then you're not left with anything. So then you're not obligated. Not only are you not obligated, you're not allowed. I wrote an article about this in the CJN a number of months ago, that you're not allowed to give charity if it means you're on a subsidy allocation. In other words, you're exempt from charity. Your first obligation is to educate your children. But everybody likes to get a break. They feel better if they can give $5,000 here and then they'll ask for a subsidy. You can't do that. The first obligation is to provide for your needs. So you're correct. If your needs take up all the money, then you don't have to give the 10%. But if they don't, you can't say, well, I only have to give, my living expenses are $50,000, but I make $100,000 net, and my living expenses are only 50. So I only have to give the 10% on the remaining 50. No, you have to give 10% on the whole 100. But for some people, it's intuition, they can't afford it, so it turns out the living expenses work as an exemption. But that's when we're, you're not, in other words, to give a common example, they're at the JNF, not to pick on them, whatever, they're making a dinner, and you want to put in a full-page ad because your friend is being honored. It's going to cost you $1,000. And yet, you're getting a $5,000 subsidy from your day school. You can't do that. What's right? Do you have to take money from them? You don't have to support that charity. God created a world where they're rich and they're poor. It's not your obligation to solve the world's problems. Your obligation is to take care of needs. If you have money, to give charity. Rav Moshe Feinstein, again, like, takes this to a little bit of an extreme where I don't know that, I agree, but I think there are other views in Jewish law. Rav Moshe Feinstein said there's no obligation to work, to make money, to give charity. If you have money, you have to give charity. But there are people like that. They say, you know what, I want to make a lot of money. I'm going to go into business. I'm going to work really hard. And I'm going to make a lot of money. And I'm going to be a philanthropist. Right? So it could be, I personally think for some people that's a great idea. They're not cut out for learning. They're not, that's what they want to do. And they're going to work extra hard. Maybe that's their mission in life. Rav Moshe Feinstein says no. Rav Moshe Feinstein, if he happens to have a great business, he has to give a lot of charity. But you don't have to work extra. You know, I'll retire at 50. So I say, how can you retire at 50? If you keep working, you'll make $1 billion in your business in the next like 10 years. You can give $100 million extra to charity. So I would think a person like that, maybe they should work. I don't know. But it's hard. Right. It's not an obligation to work with. Yeah. He's not saying, right, absolutely. But you shouldn't feel like you're obligated. So you know what? You're on tuition subsidy. You're not obligated to go to the dinners. Not only you're not obligated, you become not allowed. Now, where do you draw the line? Does that mean I have to give, I'm not allowed to give $18? I can't be a member of a shul? What does that mean? So what I wrote, you know, very briefly in the newspaper, in my article, was that being a member of a shul isn't charity either. I wanted to get to that. What is considered charity? Being a member of a shul isn't charity, by the way, and tuition isn't charity. The government, they give us a break, it's not charity. And that's here in the last source on the first page. Maybe I'll do that inside. Okay. On the second last line on the page, on the first page, I'll just read the ein la'asot mima'aser shelo dvar mitzvah. One is not permitted to from his tithe, from his, you know, his 10% or 20% a dvar mitzvah. Something you're already obligated in doing. So you're obligated not because of tzedakah. I'm going to buy tefillin for my son for his bar mitzvah. That's not tzedakah. I have an obligation as the mitzvah of tefillin. My neighbor is very poor, and I'm going to buy my neighbor's son tefillin. That is already tzedakah. So if you're smart, you'll buy him tefillin, he'll buy you tefillin. Right? No, it doesn't work that way. But so it's the same thing. So day school education is a mitzvah, it's an obligation. So it's not tzedakah. Now, after you pay day school tuition, you may not have enough money left over for tzedakah. You're exempt. Then you don't have to give 10%. You just have to give a few dollars to feel you're giving the tzedakah. So Meiser is a form of tzedakah. The mitzvah of tzedakah is a biblical obligation. We generally assume, there's a debate about this, that the mitzvah of 10 or 20% is a rabbinic obligation. You fulfill the biblical obligation of tzedakah by giving $100 a year, $500 a year. But the mitzvah of Meiser, the rabbinic obligation of charity to give 10 or 20%, is fulfilled only at that higher level. Right. Tuition's not really tzedakah. Now, if you give a $10,000 donation to a school, for you pay for your grandchildren, perhaps. That's a very interesting question. Is paying for your grandchildren, is that stuck or not? Because there may be an obligation on a grandparent or grandchild too. I have to think about that, actually. Yeah, often the grandparents, it's much easier for them to pay. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. But I'm talking now technically. So what do I mean by this? Where is this relevant? This is relevant on a millionaire. A guy who's making $500,000 a year. And after paying the $50,000 in charity and his tax and everything, he still has, in his living standards, he still has a few hundred thousand dollars left over. So he should be giving, you know, I would say a person making $500,000 should be giving 20% at that level. Most people, unless they have 11 kids or something. So then they should be giving $100,000. They shouldn't deduct the tuition off. But for most middle-class people in practice in Toronto, even if they pay the full tuition, many of them cannot afford to give the 20% or even 10% or even 5%. So what they should do, they have to take their shul, their school, whatever they're obligated to, and each one they'll pay 85%, whatever they, if they're on a subsidy. But to give to causes that are beyond what you're absolutely obligated to give, first you have to do what you're obligated, the money left over. If God blesses you with money, you give stuck. If God doesn't bless you, you don't give. You don't have to feel bad about it. I'm paying tuition. You don't have to feel bad about it. Yeah, absolutely. No, again, I don't think it counts necessarily as stuck, although, but it would relieve you from the obligation of stuck. Obviously, the first mitzvah of tzedakah is to relatives. Remember, the first mitzvah of tzedakah is to give money to relatives. Then you give to people in your city, then beyond the city, etc. So, technically speaking, the Talmud says that after a child reaches the age of maturity, which in Talmudic times was younger than it is now, kids grew up a lot quicker, the life expectancy was a lot less. So everything was done in fewer years, is technically a mitzvah of tzedakah. In other words, it could be, and again, I don't want to get too bogged down into this, detail, that sending a child for a year in Israel maybe is already tzedakah. Maybe you're not obligated to send them to a year in Israel. Because, in other words, where do you draw the line between what you're obligated to do in day school? You know, that's not 100% clear. So I would say that's not really right. Yeah. So I will say something on this issue. At what point is a person poor? In other words, his living expenses. So you can say he doesn't need a car, doesn't need cable, he doesn't need a cell phone. Yeah. You grew up with the cell phone. You grew up with a computer. You can live without a computer, without a cell phone, without a car. You can live without that. You don't have to go to Florida. You can live. So, very interesting enough, the general thrust of the rabbinic authorities is that poverty is defined by society. In other words, I can say I don't need a flush toilet either. 100 years ago, they went out to... You don't say that. Once society has a certain expectation that everybody, to be a Canadian, it's to live in Israel without the cell phone. You know, you can't... I don't know, I don't want to get, is a computer in and cable TV out? I'm not getting there. But the point being that we do recognize that if everybody in your society has a car, and you live, it's very hard to live today. And if you don't live in down there, you live in the suburbs, it's almost impossible. It's not, if you have kids, with kids especially, almost impossible without a car. And everybody has a car, so that would probably be a legitimate living expense. But what kind of car? Everybody has to, sort of adjust for themselves. You know, the rabbis are giving us guidelines. Obviously, you have to apply them in an appropriate way. If a person buys an $850,000 house and then he turns around and he can't afford it, there's a problem here. Now, if he bought an $850,000 when he was going well and then his business, suffered, and now it's not going so well, that's a different story. Because it says in the Talmud that when you give charity, you have to give the person back to the life he was accustomed to. Now, again, that's only said by an individual, not by a community, which is the next thing I want to get to. In other words, and the Talmud says, if he had a horse to go by him, you have to give him horses and chariots. So if he's already living in his million-dollar home, and then he suffers the back, so I'm not so sure he has to sell his home, technically, in order to pay his day school. I don't know if I would say that. But to buy the home, knowing it's going to be a big struggle, is a big deal. So there is a little bit of a difference. It's our thing. So that leads me to my next question, is sort of the role of public charity and private charity. And I want to raise it on two levels here, because I want to know what's the role of corporations and business in charity, and the role of government in charity. Forget you and your $100,000. Let's talk about our society is large. Does the CIBC have an obligation to give charity? Does Olympia in New York, to take a Jewish organ, whatever. Do the Jewish, do the corporations, and especially if they're a publicly traded corporation, do they have an obligation, or conversely, do they have a right to give charity? They don't have a right. Right? Okay. Okay. Go on. There is a difference, but yeah. Let's go on. Right. Right. Okay. So let me say that the issue of corporate, Michael Broyd, who spoke here on Sunday at our conference, so he wrote, he has a long article on corporations and Jewish law. And one of his basic conclusions, he presents all the theories, is Jewish law is not fully developed an approach to modern corporations. That's the bottom line. What is their status? the halacha does not recognize the notion of a corporation. The notion of limited liability is it's not a Jewish concept. There's our damages, somebody has to pay. There's no such thing that a corporation is liable. People are liable. Jewish law does not recognize, in theory, bankruptcy through corporation. Anything, we don't recognize a corporation in a pure, there were no corporation. But we live in a society that has corporations. We recognize the civil law of the government. So we do have corporations, and Jews own corporations. But bottom line, we have to come up with an approach on corporations. So, he's not responsible. Not monetarily. No. If a 10-year-old kid playing baseball knocks the baseball into your window, it's tough luck. Honestly. Jewish law says it's bad to get involved with kids. Because if you knock a baseball into, if you break his bike with your baseball, you got to pay. But you're an adult. But as a kid, he's not responsible. And nobody in Jewish law is ever responsible for the actions of somebody else. Maybe in heaven you're responsible. God expects you to lead a more life. This is very important in corporations where you have a division. This is the basic legal thing, and that's really a whole other session, which I'm not doing in this series, on corporations. The ethical problem is you have a division of management and ownership. So who's responsible? It's the management who carries it out, so they're responsible. But it's the ownership, on a legal sense, who's responsible. So that's the problem you have, because in Jewish law, you can't make A pay for the sins of B, for the crime of B. Jewish law doesn't allow that. So to the private corporation, do we recognize it? My understanding is, and like I say, it's in flux, and that's why you'll get different responses, and everybody has to follow their own rabbi, what they say. But my understanding is that in a private corporation, we would not really recognize the corporation, and the person should be giving the maaser on the profits. Now, a corporation can invest, then it's in profit. It goes in the balance sheet. It doesn't go in the income statement, right? Obviously, he doesn't have to give 10% on the revenue. He has to give 10% on retained earnings, on the bottom line. But I would think that on a private corporation, he couldn't say, I'm taking out $100,000 and I'm leaving $1 million in the corporation and not giving charity. Right? Right. Correct. That I agree. Right. Uh-huh. Right. No, see, it's... Right. See, if the company's generating cash, I think there is a difference. When I buy stock at $10 50 years ago, or I bought a building for $50,000, the building is worth $3 million now. I don't have to give any charity till I sell it.